BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
You're listening to Front Row with Samira Ahmed.
Hello, tonight Pet Shop Boys, 40 years after it all began with this hit single, West End Girls.
Sometimes you're better off dead, there's a gun in your hand that's pointing at your head. You think you're mad, too unstable, kicking in chairs and knocking down tables in a restaurant.
They're on Front Row to talk about their new album and the art of writing perfect pop songs. We're reviewing Challengers, starring Zendaya, the much-anticipated film about sporting rivalry on the tennis court, where the game is not doubles, but a threesome. And Expressionists. We're also exploring the new exhibition at Tate Modern about Kandinsky and the painters of the Blue Rider movement, making waves in the art world a century ago. But first, Pet Shop Boys are the most successful British music duo of all time and the writers of some of the finest pop songs in British music history. Take these lines from their 1990 single So Hard. I'm always hoping you'll be faithful, but you're not, I suppose. We've both given up smoking because it's fatal. So whose matches are those? A chance encounter in a Chelsea hi-fi shop led music journalist Neil Tennant and aspiring architect Chris Lowe to develop a musical friendship that would lead them 40 years ago this month to the release of their number one debut single. West End Girls set the template for a unique blend of synths, dance rhythms and storytelling, which has continued to evolve through the decades with some 70 hit singles, including Always On My Mind, Go West and Suburbia. Their innovative eye-catching videos with filmmakers such as Derek Jarman for It's a Sin tackled homophobia at a time when to be publicly gay still carried stigma around the world. Pet Shop Boys' new album, nonetheless, is their 15th and brimful of beauty, beats and melancholy. And they came into the Front Row studio. So I want to start with the title of the album, from the debut Please to the last one Hotspot. The albums famously always have a one-word title. So what does Nonetheless tell us about where you are?
Well, Nonetheless was written during the dreaded lockdown, which is almost kind of boring to talk about. But we actually had a very creative time during lockdown. And the album is quite sort of poetic sounding, I think, in a way. It's got a sort of sense of poetry to it. And the word Nonetheless suggested, one, we've been through all of this, but nonetheless, there's a new album. And also, it's got a sort of poetry to the sound of the word.
It does. So let's talk about the first single off the album, Loneliness. I mean, tell me about that, because the video for it is quite distinctive in itself. And it's got a kind of 90s setting. Tell me about the thinking behind both the song and the film.
Well, you wrote the track, didn't you?
It's quite funny. It's a very uplifting piece of music. And then the lyric, which Neil put to it, is the opposite, which is quite... kind of what we do in a way, really. So the lyrics quite sad.
I mean, how would you describe the story of the song for those who haven't heard it?
A euphoric dance track with depressing lyrics.
The lyrics are meant to be depressing. It's about someone looking at a friend who's lonely and trying to encourage them to come out of their shell a bit more.
Another one, this, as you say, they're like poems. There's the song called Schlager Hit Parade, or Hit Parade.
Hit Parade, yeah.
There's a real 50s, 60s pop mood, and it's about the German post-war pop charts. Woraus kommt diese Idee?
This idea came from... We spend quite a lot of time in Germany, and we have an apartment in the west of Berlin, and round the corner there's a funny old gay bar, which is now shut down, and they would play 1970s and 80s pop hits and Schlager music. I mean, Schlager actually apparently means hit.
It does mean hit.
And Schlager music became very big in Germany in the 50s and the 60s after the war. And that's really what the song is about, that it was very difficult for Germans to look backwards in the 1950s. So they looked forwards, and the soundtrack to that was Schlager music.
So it was kind of upbeat
and a sort
music.
Of aggressively happy music.
Happy. Yeah. Gemütlich.
Gemütlich. And aggressively happy is quite an interesting idea, isn't it?
Sometimes it's sentimental, you know.
The future is the present now. You
someone said to us that in Schlager videos, there's whole channels of them in Germany, it's always, it's either the summer holidays and you're on a boat near Mallorca, or it's Christmas and it's snowing. That's the two go-to fantasies, really.
So a song like that, what's your contribution to the finished single? There's obviously the idea, there's the tune and the rhythm, but
because of lockdown, because of being separate, is that Chris would send me music and I would write lyrics to it, or I would send Chris lyrics and he would send it to music. And so I wrote the lyric for Schlager, Hit Parade, an idea I've had for quite a long time. Yeah. And I sent it to Chris.
To get into the spirit of the song, I Google translated it into German to make it very authentic sounding, yeah. And then wrote the music to the German translation of Neil's lyrics, and then Neil translated it, sang it back in English.
Oh, interesting.
It sounds a lot more German in German.
What do Germans make of it? I mean, have you heard any feedback already from...
It's a very uncool musical form in Germany.
Our track is actually... In a way, I was reading a review of the album that we had a couple of reviews so far, and the track that the guy didn't like was Schlager Hit Parade because it was so uncool. It's not totally authentically Schlager, but it is well on the way.
But we've never shied away from being uncool. In fact, I think being uncool is actually being cool, to go against the trend.
Well, you know, it's so interesting because you are seen as the epitome of cool. I was watching the film, which got a cinematic release of your gig in Copenhagen, and... You are adored, and it's really interesting because we don't know you, really. You keep your private lives private, but the image of Pet Shop Boys is so distinctive. What do you make of your fame, and how... I mean, it feels like you've been very careful what you've put out there.
We've never seen Pet Shop Boys as a sort of project about fame. You know, some young artists come into this and they want to be rich and famous. That wasn't our inspiration for doing this. Our inspiration was to make dance music, and... When I was younger, I used to want to be a pop star when I was a teenager. You know, when you're my age, my advanced age, meant to your childhood, you had the Beatles and also stuff like Tamla Motown. And then through your teenage years, you had David Bowie and then punk and disco music. There was a lot there to be inspired by and also to want to be part of. And I knew I could write songs. I just wanted to make that my life. But it wasn't really about fame.
Well, also, you were a bit older, weren't you, than your average pop star by the time you two...
By the time we happened, I mean, I'd worked in publishing. I worked for Marvel Comics and I worked for Smash Hits magazine.
You were young by modern standards, but at the time, that was quite unusual.
It was quite old. And Chris was, by that point, a qualified architect. So
yeah.
You'd done all of that.
Well, not quite qualified.
How close to qualified?
Almost. I'd done the first two parts. And the third part, you had to work for a year... in a practice, and during that time the Pet Shop Boys had taken off, so I never got part threes.
It's so interesting knowing that you have an architectural background and then Neil your background in pop journalism, because there's a knowledge, isn't there, about structure from your album art to your stage performances. It feels very architectural and it feels very polished. Is that something you're conscious
of? Yeah, those two things have had that sort of influence. I think the architectural thing, and Chris has a particular sort of taste, which is obviously influenced by Pet Shop Boys. I'm an editorial thinker. When you're writing a pop song, that's quite a useful skill to have, to edit it down, to make it better or something. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of cliche of music journalists saying to me, oh, so Neil, you were a pop journalist, so you learned how to write the perfect pop song. They've said that to me hundreds of times probably. And I would say, well, you're a music journalist, why don't you write a perfect pop song? Because in fact, music journalism doesn't have any impact on it at all, really. It's a different thing.
In terms of the visual style then, what do you feel you've brought with that, Chris? Because I always feel, looking at a lot of your album art and your stage costumes, I always think there's something almost Bauhaus about the use of sculptural shapes.
We've worked with Mark Farrow since almost the beginning. He has a very, very similar minimalist aesthetic to what we like. So also we were reacting against that very busy 80s graphic.
Lots of pastels and busy lines.
Yeah, and sort of squiggles all over the place and things.
When we released our first album, we had a manager then who went on to manage Brosny 17. And he had this very elaborate idea for our first album cover involving paper engineering. And us and Mark came up with the album sleeve, which was a picture the size of a postage stamp on a totally white background. And it was almost shockingly minimal for a pop record.
Yes, I can see it now. I've got it on a shelf at home.
Yeah. Mm. But consequently, it stood out. it attracted attention because it was so aggressively minimalist.
There's always a lot of space for us to autograph
to
our
sign,
records,
yes.
To sign our records, which is good things. We spend most of our lives now signing things.
Like silent movie stars in 60s Hollywood. No one knows who you are in the hipster neighborhood. Your only friend is a memory of a dream.
There's a track which is a stand-up for me on the album, which is A New Bohemia. And in my head, it was like a 60s film star reflecting on the past. Where did this one come from?
We were in some hipster area of Los Angeles, and it just made me think about how Los Angeles has had Hollywood, has had generations of famous people. And of course, fame is very fickle. And you could still be alive as a 1940s, you know, former actor or actress walking through Silver Lake or somewhere with all the coffee shops and groovy places, and no one would know who you are. And you would be thinking, actually, Sunset Boulevard is that plot, isn't it?
Yeah.
She's a silent film actress, no one knows anymore. And so I link that with the idea that something Chris and I were talking about is, so that we didn't feel we were part of a scene in London anymore, whereas in the 90s and the early noughties, I think we thought we were, in particularly around Soho and the Brit pop and Brit art era. We knew a lot of people like that then. It was a sort of quite an exciting time. And now I did personally feel I would like to find a new bohemia to be part of. And Chris wrote this very beautiful, sort of almost elegiac music. It's my favourite song on the album.
Where have they gone? Les petits bonbons. Dances now to their sweet old song. I wish I lived my life free and easier. I need to find a new
one. You do melancholy and looking back elegiately with real panache. Is that something you're more conscious of because of how long you've been in
business? I suspect it's just getting older. Although, you know, young artists can look back nostalgically from the early 20s to their teenagers. So I think it's a sort of a function of music. But I think, like Chris was saying earlier about the song Loneliness, you often get a happy track with an element of sadness to the lyrics. Our sometimes stage designer, Ez Devlin, would call that section of the show Tears in the Toilet, when you're in a club. And sometimes girls go to the loo together, don't they, and commiserate with what's going on. And that's the Tears in the Toilet moment. And I think we're always there to provide the soundtrack for that moment.
Oh, that's a lovely thought. Nonetheless, it's out tomorrow, and it's being released to coincide with the 40th anniversary of your debut single, West End Girls.
Making the most of a coincidence.
Well, it's a great coincidence. And
it is.
As you've already hinted, you know, the fact that you can look back and see how much the music scene has changed. Did you ever imagine that you would still be making music and be quite as important and successful as you are? I mean, with the touring, you know, the excitement about your music.
No, I think even now you don't really look more than a year or two ahead. I always say that when we signed to EMI, and that was in 1985, we were signed for a 7-album deal, and I thought it was a ludicrous idea we'd ever make 7 albums, because making one seemed like so much work.
Can't imagine doing anything else, though. I haven't got much longer to go. A couple of albums. What do you mean? You never know, do you?
You don't
know how long you've got. It's good to have got this far.
What do you make of the fact that live touring is such a big part of your success? Because when you started out, you know, making the perfect single was often about just the listen and maybe the video. It's an in-person experience has been really interesting development, hasn't it, in pop music?
We've actually got quite good at it, haven't we? I mean, you particularly have got...
Well, I've learnt on the job.
You've become a really good performer.
I've learnt on the job.
Yeah. I mean, I've probably got actually worse, but you got really good at it.
Well, you know, when we started, we didn't tour for the first three or four years, I think it was. It's not the background we came out of.
But even like in performing, you know, your performance isn't like jumping around and doing a really lively...
I tried to make it more like that, but no one seems to notice. The unique thing about Pet Shop Boys is that we were, I think, the first people, or following off maybe David Bowie and Grace Jones, we wanted to do something theatrical. We wanted to visualise every song. And so our instinct was right from the beginning to bring in a director, which is not normally, maybe it is now in pop music, actually, So our first director was Derek Jarman.
Well, that's
funny. The first tour for us.
I was going to ask you about that because the video for It's a Sin was featured in the exhibition, which is a retrospective of his career I saw in Manchester a couple of years ago. And it's a remarkable film. But it does, again, remind us that you're right at the cutting edge of art. You're more conceptual artists, really, aren't you?
So we were very lucky. We were mixing It's a Sin in the studio, and they often in studios they have the television on with the sound down, and the night we were mixing it, Channel 4 was showing Caravaggio, and so we phoned up Derek Jarman, and he came in the next day and he thought we wanted Super 8. We said no one would look like Caravaggio, so he got quite a big budget for it. And then we realised what an amazing person Derek was, because we knew of him anyway, and he'd done some stage work as well, and he put together really an incredible show with these dancers from LA, and he made all these Super 8 films and blew them up to huge size. It was a great experience. I mean, and since then, we've worked with various people like David Alden, David Fielding from the English National Opera, and Zaha Hadid, and Is Devlin. And
actually, we've been very lucky that these people have agreed to work with us, because they just get a call out of the blue, you know. So.
It's an interesting thing that's happened is that theatre design has taken elements now from what I would call rock music design. There's something about the spectacle of the live music show, which is really incredible, which you sort of don't get in the theatre, and they try to bring elements of that into the theatre.
And also the way that technology now has come back to the theatre.
Yeah.
Thinking back to working with Derek Jarman and thinking of that video, as gay men who became stars in the 80s, in that era of Section 28, I wonder what you make of the state of gay rights in the modern world. I mean, even your video for Loneliness is kind of a statement about the fact that still people, I know it's set in the 90s, but the sense of people not feeling,
the reason
to be
it's
honest.
Set in the 90s is because so much is online now. The sort of hookups presented in the video between men probably doesn't happen like that anymore, because it all happens on apps.
Grindr.
But I think that's a huge difference. The online thing is a huge difference in all aspects of life, though, let's face it. In regard to gay rights, you know, it's remarkable the advances that have been made. I mean, our position has always really been that in an ideal world, it wouldn't even be an issue. It shouldn't be an issue.
I'll tell you what has changed is the reaction of the record company to the video. When we made Being Boring with Bruce Weber,
1990,
I think they were quite appalled by it. 'Cause we were never being boring.
We had too much time to fight for ourselves. Bruce Weber used some footage he had of a guy, naked guy, from behind, jumping on a diving board and then into the pool with his dog. Absolutely all hell broke loose. And then, funnily enough, later in the year, it won from the Music Week Awards, Video of the Year. But nowadays, they sort of like that kind of content. It's interesting how things have changed. But not, of course, in places like Russia and Uganda, you're seeing rights, the clock being turned back.
Yeah, the world's definitely going in two different directions at the moment, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
I've got one final question, which is there was a karaoke version of your song Rent in the film Saltburn, and the film All of Us Strangers, Andrew Haig's film, featured two of your songs, and music was very central to that film, including a big dance scene in a disco to Always On My Mind. And I wonder what it means to you to have your music used in this way, because it was very purposeful, particularly, I thought, in All of Us Strangers.
Well, in both of those films, the music is used as part of the plot. So in Rent, it's a comment on, you know, his rent is in effect being paid. And in All of the Strangers, the family all sing at Christmas, Always On My Mind together. And again, it's part of the plot. And then they glance at the television and where, because it's Christmas Top of the Pops in 1987. And it's nice because normally, very often in films, particularly American films, you're aware they're going to use our music to establish. It's the second half of the 80s and we're in a gay club, so we want to use It's a Sin. And then sometimes we say no to that because it's just, they're just turning you into a cliche.
Whereas this felt?
Whereas this, both of them felt heartfelt, actually. It's love, it's love, it's love, it's a
sin. Neil Tennant and Chris Lowe of Pet Shop Boys. Their new album, Nonetheless, is out tomorrow. Now time for the first of our two reviews. Challengers, a love triangle thriller about tennis players starring Zendaya and directed by the maker of the Oscar-winning film Call Me By Your Name, Luca Guadagnino. Patrick and Art are best friends on and off the court, but when they see a new female player called Tashi at their Challenger tournament, they suddenly become rivals. This short extract from the trailer captures that sense of rivalry when the men invite her back to their room after she's won at the tournament.
How often does this happen? Going after the same girl?
Not as often as you think.
We usually have different types.
So you're saying I should be flattered?
Aren't you everybody's type?
It was a very short clip. I'm sorry about that. Josh O'Connor and Mike Feist with Zendaya in Challengers. Our reviewers tonight are writer Jenny McCarthy and art critic Catherine McCormack. Jenny, there has been so much hype about this film, Tennis as Sex and Sex as Tennis. How would you describe Challengers?
Well, I felt like it's about a tennis game, and I felt like it's constructed like a game. It's there for you to enjoy. It's trying to lure the audience in, and actually it worked for me. I was, to a large extent, captured by it. I thought it was very cleverly done. I feel like you know what you're getting with this director. He's preoccupied with desire and its disruptive effects and the surfaces of things and, you know, sunshine and sweat. And in his previous films, like A Bigger Splash or Call Me By Your Name, you know, it all happened around a swimming pool. And here it changes. It's a love triangle around a different rectangle, the tennis court.
Yeah.
But there's a hyped up sense of construction. But it moves, although it's quite a long film, it moves fast. The dialogue is witty. It's cleverly plotted. And I like the way it was structured. Sort of, at first I found it a little jarring, these new kind of time references flashing up.
The film is set over the course of a tense match between the two men, but we flash back during this match over the past 13 years.
Yes.
So that's the framework. And so it makes it a mystery that's gradually revealed.
That's right. And once you get used to that, I quite enjoyed the artfulness of it.
Catherine, it is, as Jenny was saying, by the director of Call Me By Your Name, which was acclaimed for its portrayal of a gay romance. How erotic did you actually find Challengers?
Oh, excellent question, Samira. Thank you. Well, I think that Guadagnino, in my experience of seeing things like Call Me By Your Name, his work is normally quite subtle with his storytelling and the simmering eroticism, often queer eroticism and sort of fluid desires. But I think Challengers is a really sort of in-your-face romp of a menage a trois that hits us over the head, literally with a tennis racket, with kind of a few main points. And one of those is that tennis is sexy. We have this endless depiction of beads of dripping sweat as this kind of index of sexuality and desire. The idea that what happens on the tennis court is a mirror of what happens in relationships, with the rallying back to forth. And the most emphatic point, I think, that we're never allowed to forget is that Zendaya is the most desirable woman in the entire world. And that's hammered home both through the camera work, which I found really retro in some ways, actually. I found it really sort of collapsed into a classic male gaze, tracking of Zendaya's body, her thighs, up her legs. It couldn't get enough of her flesh, to the extent that at some points it felt like a slightly goofy teen movie. I was getting a little bit of kind of Weird Science vibes when they're both, when they're initially completely flabbergasted by her sort of sexual prowess and desirability. It collapsed into that. But I agree with Jenny's sort of suggestion about it being about desire, but I found it was very much catered to male desire and male erotics. And even if that does include an expanded sort of same-sex desire with all the sauna scenes, then this quite forced, I found, invitation for us to read the relationship between the two males, between Feist and O'Connor as charged with same-sex desire.
I felt this really failed to deliver on all of that. There's one scene where they all kiss, and then there's never anything more of the backstory of what might have happened afterwards.
But that's the thing. I think it always, in terms of sexuality, it always promises more than it delivers. But I quite like that about it. It's a giant tease. And I thought its tongue is in its cheek. And it's kind of, there's an element of camp. There's an element of ramping things up with the thumping house music and, you know, the sweat falling like rain. And there's a parodic element to it that I frequently find it quite funny. Yeah.
Catherine was hinting that, you know, Zendaya, she gets top billing. But I wonder how far we really got a fully drawn female character. Because there are occasional references to such interesting issues as the racism. And she mentions that player, don't feel sorry for her, she's a racist. Or that police will assume she's a prostitute if they see her in a car late at night with a man. But none of these, I thought, were ever developed.
I agree. I think that the arc of her character was really unsatisfying. And for me, actually, that was the most unsatisfying element of the entire film. I felt that it left me with lots of questions about what defines the sort of female power that she is ostensibly representing. And does it depend on taut thighs, glossy hair, and this kind of utter imperviousness to the world around her? In terms of ever softening, she's facilitating these men's ascent into a tennis game. She has the, you know, there's a bit where her career is ended. That's a potential kind of denouement, but that's never really explored as the repercussions of that, how that sort of affects her development and her interiority.
But I quite enjoyed the fact that what she is raw, sleek ambition. And she is obsessed primarily with tennis. And so I think that there is another film that could be made with the unexplored plot lines in this one, whether that's to do with race or whether it's to do with being a mother, because she's a mother, but she's decidedly unmaternal and the child just makes sort of bit part appearances. But I think, you know, going back to the sort of geometry of the film, it's about tennis, sex, desire and control. It's about this tightly plotted thing. And I think that were it to go too far down those other avenues, it would lose that tautness. Mm.
See, I thought, again, that the hint of homoeroticism, there's a scene where one of them has become a bit of a failure. And but when he flicks through his dating app, it throws up the occasional man as well as, and he's looking for a woman to sleep with, just be able to save the money for a hotel.
Yes.
But there's also a reference to the fact that he comes from a rich family and Tasha says, why don't you get back in touch with them? We never saw any of this. And I think if this was a TV movie in the 70s, and I saw a lot of movies that were sort of about sports, like ice castles and romance, it would have been over in 90 minutes with a big emotional heart.
Yeah, well, I'm quite glad it didn't.
2 hours 20.
I don't think you're necessarily required to love any of them. I don't think any of them is really a moral heart of the film.
That?
It is a game.
Yeah.
And their dialogue is very cruel often to each other, but they're resilient, as one is in tennis. They have to get back up again and you know, put the ball back over the net.
Yeah. I was thinking, you know, tennis, it's not like we don't think of tennis as being an incredibly exciting and, you know, dramatic watch. And I just thought, how far does Challengers take us anywhere comparable to live elite coverage of Wimbledon? I mean, I think Wimbledon already does that, doesn't it, when you watch tennis.
I thought there was a lot of sort of very enforced shots, crotch shots of every opportunity. It was whether it was the umpire with his splayed legs, whether it was the players and their rest breaks in between. I think Jenny's right in saying that there is this parallel in thinking about the sleek ambition of Zendaya and what's necessary to succeed in the sporting world is also similar to what's necessary for women to succeed, the enormous pressures of reaching success and wealth and elite status in society, which Zendaya represents. So I enjoyed those parallels there.
But I did also feel like the director was an equal opportunities voyeur. I mean, we got a lot of the male bodies.
We got some genuine male nudity.
But don't you think that was seen through male lens? It was seen as the kind of locker room scene where there's the suggestion of the flip through the dating app where he lingers for a second thinking it might be a man that he might hook up with. I felt that it was done for them rather than for any female gaze. I felt that
mocked the helplessness of men when they're trapped in desire, because that moment where she walks in and they're both crippled by lust. I mean, it was funny.
You say that. I think as a woman watching it, you feel incredibly disturbed for the potential of rape walking in willingly into a room with two men. And obviously the film doesn't go there. But I just thought, you know, there was a completely missing female gaze on this film.
100%. And I think the sexual precociousness of Zendaya in the early part when she's meant to be 18 or 19, I found really actually genuinely unsettling.
Disturbing,
at the risk
almost,
of sounding like a pearl-clutching kind of feminist. I found that really unsettling, is the way she orchestrates that three-way kiss.
Yeah, I know. Well, we could talk about this for ages, but thank you. You've given us a really good flavour of what an interesting thriller it is. Catherine McCormack, Jenny McCartney, thank you. Challengers is in cinemas from Friday, certificate 15, because the sex is not that explicit. I bet there is no sex we actually see. Now, while Challengers claims to be showing us young men and women breaking boundaries and challenging conventions, we turn now to some who really did. 100 years ago, a group of avant-garde artists across the German and Russian empires were seeing and painting the world around them in a new way, in wild colours, an abstract shapes. A new exhibition at Tate Modern, Expressionists, Kandinsky, Munter and the Blue Rider, explores the friendships and groundbreaking painting styles of such figures as Vasily Kandinsky, Mariana von Werefkin and Franz Marc. There are portraits of city life in wild reds and yellows, mountain landscapes in vivid blues and greens, where a cow can become a huge, more sinister figure, and a church is dwarfed by the giant mountains casting the chill of a cool sunset. And there is a sense of the darkness to come. Some died in the First World War, and then came the Nazis' rise to power in the 1930s. Catherine, some of the names in this exhibition are very familiar, but could you describe the world that we enter in this exhibition?
Sure, yeah, it's a really nice world. I found it a really sort of settling and inspiring and colourful world, as you've already hinted at. So when we use this term expressionism, I think it's useful to remember that's a bit of a term that sort of caters to a loose ragbag of ideas in Germany and parts of the former Russian Empire in the early years of the 20th century that congregated around Vasily Kandinsky and Gabriel Munter in Munich in this bohemian community of artists supporting one another. And I think that sense of friendship and collective was quite an emphatic point in the show. And I think that was sort of done to jettison what's now a very unfashionable way of producing exhibitions, which is the monographic show dedicated to the individual genius. Mm. So one of the artists that we might see in a overview of German expressionism or this European expressionism might be Kandinsky, who's often held up as the grandfather of abstraction and his translations of Schoenberg's musical compositions into visual form and this wonderful synesthesia of music into painting. But we see him against the backdrop of a number of other artists, including a lot of women artists. Now, some of these were quite familiar. There was a Royal Academy show about 18 months ago,
which focused, some of the same
paintings, and there was a clutch, there was a handful of ones that had been in that show, such as Werefkin and Gabriel Munter. But that didn't matter. I thought it was great to have some more time with them and see them as part of a collective.
Jenny, I felt this incredible wash of colour, the blue and the purple palette that just overwhelmed me as I went through the rooms. What was your experience of the show?
Well, I loved it because getting the portraits, the pictures all there together, it really gave you this sense of a collective and of them influencing each other. And one always thinks, oh, Kandinsky's known for colour. But actually the way that the rest of them used colour was astonishing as well. I mean, if you look at Marianne Werefkin's self-portrait, she's got sort of red irises and blue whites of her eyes, and somehow it works. And then Gabriel Munter's portrait of Werefkin is equally sort of stunning in a different style. So I thought it actually was very good in the way that it gave you the wider group. Yeah. But there was something also sort of touching and innocent about their reaching to break down boundaries of all kinds. So they were interested in children's art and folk art and devotional art. They were interested in sort of international ideas. And then again, breaking these categories between, you know, sound and colour and this synesthesia that you were mentioning. I find quite extraordinary, actually.
I think there's this overlap with other styles of the 20th century that listeners might be familiar with, such as fauvism and that sort of unexpected use of colour. And there's that wonderful Elizabeth Epstein self-portrait in the first room that was full of portraits and this patchwork of pink and lavender and yellow planes of flesh. And she's really sort of fills the canvas with this stout matronly presence, which I really adored.
Can I ask about the sense of geography of this art movement? Particularly there's this town of Murnau, where many of the artists gathered. And tell me about the sense of place, how that enriched the experience of viewing these paintings.
I loved that room, actually. I especially loved the Kandinsky in that room with these, and you've already mentioned the, I think it was Kandinsky who did the image of the cow.
Yeah.
And this sort of destabilizing vision of landscape that's also at the same time, it's sort of pastoral, but looking at the pastoral in a way that avoids the picturesque and tries to say something new about it. This sort of experiments in looking. And I think that really characterizes what you're saying about this halcyon moment, which we know looking back retrospectively, that was a chapter that was soon to close in the most horrific way possible with the outbreak of the First World War and Europe's descent into ideological totalitarianism and dictatorships. So I think that sense of place there was lovely. Also in the Bohemian quarter of Munich, I mean, I felt like I could have...
I wanted to go there.
Old Europe.
Yeah.
And make art.
Did you make of the geography, because that was a big part of the storytelling, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And the actual, well, I think Murnau is about 70 miles or kilometres away from Munich. And so the artists could come, and Kandinsky and Munter were there as a sort of locus of this whole thing. So I
love
that.
And it's connected to Expressionist cinema, isn't it?
Yes.
As well.
Yeah. It was ultimately where I think she died. She went back there.
Yes.
But then
yes.
I think also touching on what happened later, I find it kind of sorrowful that it was this hub of kind of fresh ideas and colour. And then it sort of, you know, the Bavaria became kind of known for Hitler being there, and for and of course all of this art was deemed, a lot of it was deemed degenerate art and rejected by the Nazis, and so it got kind of crushed, the idea of it got crushed by this very categorizing mentality.
It's remarkable that, I mean, and that is part of the story that we see in the exhibition, isn't it?
And I do believe, I might be wrong here, but I think Nosferatu might have been sort of filmed there as well.
Yeah,
when
that's
you mentioned cinema,
Murnau,
I think
yes,
it was
the film director. Was from there.
There was other geographical references as well, and I thought the way the show opened was thinking of the Expressionists or Kandinsky and Munter as having an ethnographic lens. So I thought it's quite interesting to open the show with her Kodak photographs of going to the USA in the early 20th century,
yes,
and Kandinsky exploring parts of the Russian Empire.
Kind of unique eye, didn't she?
Absolutely.
There's photographs of those African American women dressed in their Sunday best.
Incredibly beautiful and elegant.
That sort of tempered what we think of as being very much a painterly movement that's just about the application of paint on canvas, to sort of see those photographs. Also the section on Tunisia and made me think about the parallels with people like Vanessa Bell and the Bloomsbury Group. And I think there is a certain overlap in the style as well, with the way in which they were keen to see, on one hand, just another kind of light and the play of light in other more other countries in the Southern Hemisphere.
Can I ask Jenny quickly, what's your standout from that exhibition?
I think Franz Marx Tiger, of course, but I was also just really interested in Kandinsky's The Cow, not because I thought it was the best painting, but I was fascinated by the way that the form of this ruminant entirely collapsed.
I know.
And it became
it's
a kind
baffling.
Of thing of colour.
What about for you, Catherine?
I really loved Marianne Verifkin's tempera paintings, actually. I love, there's one called The Skaters, which is in the section which talks about her involvement with the theatre. And actually, she was an interesting character.
Which is to say, you've got the moonlight over these skaters and dark shadows,
and this kind of
glow.
The warm glow of the inside of the building, and then the reflection of the moonlight and these silhouetted skaters going round in this wonderful dance of that quite notationally painted figures going around this exquisite dance. I thought I would love to see more of her work, even a solo show. I thought she was really interesting for being a patron of the arts as well. Was referred to as a man woman. Something interesting there about how she occupied a male realm in supporting artists.
My final question then is, I mean, given we know some of these painters were condemned by the Nazis as degenerate, what was the legacy of the Blue Rider movement in the history of art? How do you see that?
Well, I think there was a bit of an exploration into that towards the end of the exhibition. Well, they produced an almanac. They had two experimental shows, which took place before the outbreak of the First World War. And then they assembled this almanac, which was a collation of their friends' work. 1938, there was an exhibition in London, I believe, that showed some of their works, which then exposed them to a mid-century generation of European artists.
So it kind of needed the outside of Nazi Germany to sort of bring them out, and that's how they've survived as important figures in the art world.
But also being cut short by the First World War.
Yeah.
I mean, Franz Marc died at Verdun. Yeah. You think of all that colour, and you think of the absence of colour in those killing fields.
Yeah. And all of his spirituality as well. I found that really fascinating, how they embraced spirituality in this kind of secular way.
And of course that would have challenged kind of the very religious ideas.
Absolutely.
At the time. Thank you. Catherine McCormack, Jenny McCartney, thank you. We've been talking about Expressionists, Kandinsky, Munter and the Blue Rider, which is on at Tate Modern in London until mid-October. I wanted to ask you both about your cultural picks. Catherine, do you want to go first?
I'd love to, thank you. So I've been rereading a book which I came across last year called Forbidden Notebook by a Cuban-Italian author called Alba de Cespedes. And I came to this work through reading Elena Ferrante and my passion for Elena Ferrante and a project that I'm working on regarding her work at the moment. So it has a lot of the hallmarks that readers of Ferrante would appreciate, the sort of lean clarity of expression in thinking about the interior of women's lives. And
it's written in 1952.
Written in 1952. And
what's it about?
It talks about a woman who is defined by her duties within patriarchy as a wife and mother, but also for financial circumstances and necessity, takes a job in an office. And one Sunday, when out buying cigarettes for her husband, she buys a notebook and starts to write in it. And this process of writing becomes a process of confronting her own interior thoughts, which don't have a space elsewhere in her life. And it becomes this clandestine exercise that she has to hide from the rest of her family and go to great lengths to do so.
Well, I think we'll have to leave it there. Jenny, what have you chosen?
Well, I've chosen a book by Charles Marville called, it's in French, Une Mémoire de Vieux Paris, A Memory of Old Paris. And he was a photographer, mid-19th century, who took... who photographed Paris as it was changing, as Baron Haussmann was demolishing
medieval streets,
Paris,
yeah,
and putting up the Grand Boulevard that we know today. But it's just fascinating because it's still fairly early days of photography and you're getting a glimpse of Paris as it may have been, you know, 70 years earlier during the Revolution, and that it had sort of evolved since medieval times. So it's this glimpse of a hidden city.
That's amazing. It's like a time portal into the past.
Yes, it's fascinating.
Thank you so much to my reviewers tonight, Jenny McCartney and Catherine McCormack. On Monday, I'll be talking to Hanif Qureshi on the new stage adaptation of his novel, The Buddha of Suburbia. And I'll be talking to the chief executive, Darren Henley, of Arts Council England. But before we go, a reminder that the programme for the BBC Proms is out today. Highlights include a disco prom, and both the Verdi Requiem and the Britain War Requiem, plus the return of the Berlin Philharmonic, who will be performing with pianist Víkingur Ólafsson, Front Row's former lockdown artist in residence. He'll be playing Schumann's Piano Concerto. So we're going to leave you tonight with Víkingur and Schumann. Thanks for listening to Front Row. I'm Samira Ahmed and the producer was Paula McGrath. The production coordinator was Lizzie Harris and our studio manager was Andrew Garrett. And if you enjoyed this programme, you can discover more radio, music and podcasts on BBC Sounds.